which is not in the flow directly of what we've been doing. But let's have a look at that subject. Now, we'll probably, this is a very, very detailed and difficult subject. The principle is easy and simple, but the details are many. Let's try and, first of all, understand the problem, and then let's see if we can understand part of the answer. What you're going to hear now is one of the most fundamental things there are in Torah. Okay? You can't do without this idea. You can't do without it. You can't understand anything in Torah without this idea, and it's exactly the opposite of what's taught. Certainly in the non-Jewish world, definitely, and in the uninformed Jewish world, definitely, this idea is completely held upside down. And it's a result, what results from it is complete misunderstanding of the whole Torah, tremendous confusion, paradoxes, the whole system doesn't make sense. And many people, unfortunately, they have a negative feeling about many things in Yiddishkeit because of this problem. Now, if you, you'll see the problem is very difficult. We discussed this before some months ago. As I said, we're doing it again now because people requested it. And you'll see that the problem is very difficult. If it's so difficult to you that you're convinced in the beginning, right, that you're not going to be able to understand the answers, then leave now. And this is the kind of thing that you have to be able to hear. Once you hear it, you'll see it's absolutely obvious, fundamental. It couldn't be any other way. It doesn't need any proof. But if you haven't been used to hearing it this way, then it may be difficult to hear. But again, this is a subject that you have to want to hear. You have to listen with sensitivity. You have to open yourself to a way that you don't normally think. And you'll see that it couldn't be any other way. But it's hard, I'm warning you, because we've been taught very, very badly and very much the opposite. The problem is as follows. We have a concept that the people that we talk about in Tanakh, the greats of Jewish history, like King David, David HaMelech, Moshe Rabbeinu, the great people who went out of Egypt, that generation that was saved, Joshua, Joshua's time, the sons of Yaakov, the tribes, the 12 tribes, the people at that, in that order of magnitude, that greatness, we have an understanding that's fundamental to Torah, that their greatness was so intense that we can't begin to understand it. Their sensitivity, their refinement, their closeness to perfection in spiritual terms, which means in self-control, the work that they had done on themselves, that brought themselves to a level that was so close to perfection that we can't vaguely begin to understand it. On the other hand, we see in Tanakh that they did the most terrible sins. That's the problem. Sins that I definitely wouldn't do. We spoke last week, the reason we got onto this was because last week we had occasion to discuss King David, David HaMelech, who took a man and had him killed so he could commit adultery with his wife. Very, very lowly. You remember, we discussed this. A very lowly way of going about things. And to make matters worse, the Tanakh says so. The Tanakh says so. If you read Chumash, you read Tanakh, not only does it say they did these bad things, but it almost says nothing else. If you read through Tanakh from beginning to end, you'll find very, very few positive comments. The comments of love between Hashem and us, compliments that he gives us for being a great people, they're not that many. There are some ones that we cherish, but not that many. But are plenty of criticism. Vitriolic castigation from beginning to end. You're a no good people, you deserted me, you murdered widows, and a whole kind of terrible things it says about us from beginning to end. Now, so you're beginning to hear there's a different problem over here. Right? We're saying that these people were on the level of perfection. This was a nation that is so close to the ultimate greatness that we can't even begin to understand it. The number of mistakes they made in the most sensitive and refined areas, almost zero, almost nothing. And the worst mistakes they made, ever. Right? I'm going to try and show you, were almost perfection, let alone mistakes. They were so close to acts of greatness and perfection that they can't even begin to understand what was wrong about them. On the other hand, the Tanakh says that they did very, very bad things. Very bad things. Are you with me? How do we understand this? How do you put these things together? How do you make any sense of it? What's the Jewish understanding of it? Now let's try and... That was the introduction to the question. Huh? Let's try and understand the question. Before we get to the answer, let's understand the greatness of the conflict between these two areas. First of all, what was the greatness of these people? Just to understand vaguely the league that we're talking about. Yes? If you talk about anybody in Jewish history that's mentioned in Tanakh, to try and explain, first of all, there's no way we can grasp their greatness at all. But just to try and get a vague idea about where it reaches, we'd have to spend hours and hours and hours. In fact, no amount of discussion would do it. So everything that might give a vague hint is somebody who's ever studied Torah, studied the works of those generations, and maybe, if you're lucky, met anyone who's still alive who carries with him some of the greatness of the previous generation. And if you've done that, and then you hear him speak about how great his Rebbe was, making it clear that he's absolutely nothing compared to his Rebbe, and he tells you his Rebbe spoke that way about his Rebbe, with the accurate tradition that it goes back that way, in fact it goes exponentially more that way, by the time you get back a few generations, we can't begin to understand their greatness. Let's try and do it briefly. We can't do it fully, but, and you don't have to accept it from me, but just to try and lay out what is the Jewish approach to the situation. We're talking about, what can I tell you? If you've ever had the experience, really the only way to go about it is to experience it. You should pack your things and go to Yerushalayim while there's still a few people alive from that, from the previous generation. People who knew the Chofetz Chaim. Don't speak to people who just once saw the Chofetz Chaim. Never mind what their level is. And see what kind of a person lives in the world after just having laid eyes on a man like this. People who've seen him, people who saw him, the Chofetz Chaim died in 1933. People who saw him say that if you ever laid eyes on him, you were never the same again. All you had to do was see him. If you look at a picture of the Chofetz Chaim, you'll see he was a disheveled, sort of looking old man with a wagon driver's hat. You would have missed him in the streets. But if you knew anything about him and you actually perceived what he was, you looked at him, you'd never be the same again. You can get some of this feel from pictures if you have good pictures of the last generation or two. You can get something of it. To share with you my personal feeling about it would be, I'd have to tell you experiences I've had. I'm not going to go through a long list of them. But I've had experiences of sitting face to face with people whom I regard as out of this world. So I've met people, I think I've met people, whom if you would meet, you'd never be the same again. And those people tell me, they laugh in embarrassment when you discuss them or their generation compared to one generation before. I know a man in Yerushalayim who, this man right now, Leon Horace or Zain Gazult, he's 90 years old. He's one of the world's famous Rosh Hashivas. His father was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman from the last previous generation. I've been lucky, fortunate to have contact with this great man over the last few years. Here's a person who is a Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva. No mystical stuff at all. He will refuse to discuss anything mystical with you. You try and ask him any question about any hidden area, he tells you, how does he put it? He says to me, the way once I asked him about the mystical wisdom, so he's got very piercing blue eyes. He leaned across the table and he said to me, when I was 17, I wanted to know about the mystical wisdom. So I started studying a certain book, and he named the book, a book of mystical studies. And he said, I had a headache for 3 days. Then he said, you know what? I decided I was too young. And he leaned across the table and he said to me, and I'm still too young. Don't touch it. So there's a person who won't admit to have any contact with the mystical. What's his level? When I walk in to see him, the last contact I had on this level was when I had, I'm not going to go through the story, I had a very difficult personal problem in my own life, how to organize certain things, it was very complex, many different personalities involved, a great complexity. It took me 4 days to work out an introduction to my question so that I could just make him like conversant with all the variables in the situation so that I could then ask him my question. And I worked on it till I had my introduction down to 20 minutes. In 20 minutes I practiced it so I could give him a good idea about everything that he needed to know so that I could then ask my question because I needed guidance. So I walked into his home in Yerushalayim and I sat down and I said, look, I've come to ask you a question. And as I was in the middle of the first sentence of my introduction, he said, look, your question is the following. He said exactly what the question was, he told me the answer. It was. So of course I carried on with my introduction and I said, after about a minute I kind of peeped it out and I left, you know. I've seen that time and again, and this is somebody, if you thought this was impressive and you expressed that to him, you wouldn't know what you're talking about. It was obvious to him. Now, he tells you stories about his life when he lived with the Chofetz Chaim in Ravna, what he saw. He tells you mostly, that means mystical, miraculous events that he personally experienced with the Chofetz Chaim, right, that are out of this world. And you see a man like this, who's one of the world's greatest living people, speaks of this teacher that he had with an awe that's impossible to convey. Now, we have an accurate tradition that the Chofetz Chaim spoke about his Rebbe that way. The Chofetz Chaim spoke about Reb Nachum, who was his Rebbe. He told his boys, the Chofetz Chaim told his Talmidim in Yeshiva, he told his stories about his Rebbe that he was unable to comprehend the greatness of Reb Nachum. We follow. And we're still only dealing with the late Achronim. When you go back to the Shoinim, we have a principle in Torah tradition that we take a quantum leap into another world. We haven't even touched those yet, the Ramban. the Gaon of Vilna, Reb Chaim Volozhin. Reb Chaim Volozhin was a star pupil of the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon died in 1790 something. He was one of the Achronim, and not part of the Rishonim. Although some say he was as great as people 500 years before. But nevertheless, what we're explaining here is the principle in Jewish life that we go down and down and down and down. Okay, the Mashiach will come to the heel, the soles of the feet of human history, and we're there now. It's impossible to imagine going lower. We hope, but we're at the bottom of history now. But the further back we go, the greater we go. Not like a non-Jewish world. They think the further back you go, you eventually hit a cave someplace. Right? We understand that you hit the level of angelic dimensions if you go back far enough. That's where we see the world. They're right, actually. But there are people who come from caves. We don't. We come from an angelic level. But that has to be discussed in detail. But like this. The Chaim Volozhin was the star pupil of the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna was somebody that you can't begin to understand. If you just read his writings, you don't have to take it from me. You get a little bit of a feeling for Torah insight, and you start. He wrote, apart from major halakhic works, right? He wrote some of the most central Kabbalistic explanations and explications that we have today. And there's no, you don't have to take it from me, you can actually experience it. You take a Zohar, or even earlier works that he commented on, and you see his commentary on these works. After reading those, you know, just a beginning of somebody to show you and hold your hand through it, you definitely wouldn't be the same again. Not that I've studied the Vayinimis, but I've seen one or two things. You'll be definitely not be the same again. That was the Gaon of Vilna. They say, you know, the Maharal who lived in the 1600s once was in a desperate situation where the Jewish community in Prague was threatened by the non-Jews, and the only way out was to create a semi-human creature called the Golem. The Maharal created a semi-human creature. He couldn't speak, but he was very physically powerful, and he saved the Jews from many lethal troubles that they had at the time. You know? That was in the 1600s. The Gaon, we have records that the Gaon was busy making a golem. The Gaon himself, the Gaon of Vilna, in the late 1700s. He's busy making a golem, but he said that he got a message from above to stop because he wasn't yet bar mitzvah. Hmm? What are we talking about? The Chaim Volozhin, who was the star pupil of the Gaon, once they asked him how he's ready the Gaon of Vilna compared to the Rambam. The Rambam lived in the 1100s. 10 and 1100s, died in 1135, the way the non-Jews count. The year 1135. 850, 860 years ago. The Rambam was one of the greatest rishonim. When I asked him how he's ready the Gaon of Vilna compared to the Rambam, now you have to understand that you're asking the student of a Rebbe. There's no greater love in the world than a student for his Rebbe. In fact, in some ways it's closer than for a father. In some laws you have to observe closeness to your Rebbe preceding that of closeness to your father. So they couldn't have been asking anybody who loved anybody more than they asked Reb Chaim. They asked him, how does your Rebbe compare in greatness to the Rambam? And he answered the following thing. He said, if he would learn for 100 years, he wouldn't come up to the instep of the Rambam. That's what he said about his own Rebbe. And that is an understatement. The Gemara says that if people of that generation were like men, the next generation were like donkeys. The Gemara says, it says if they were like angels, the next was like men, and the next generation was like donkeys. The Gemara says that they were like donkeys compared to the previous generation. So, and we've taken an exponential dive. That was the Rambam. And you don't have to take it from me. Study Rambam. Look at what he wrote. If you could just fathom how he could put together what he put together. Rashi. Nobody's got any conception of what Rashi. You have access to Rashi. You don't have to take it from me. Look at Rashi. Rashi wrote the commentary on everything that we have. Rashi wrote the commentary on Chumash. He wrote the commentary on the whole Gemara 3 times. We use the 3rd edition. He wrote on Sifri, on Sifra, on Medrash, on Tehillim. Rashi wrote on everything. And every word in Rashi has an endless depth. And again, don't take it from me. Sit with the Rashi. The deeper you plumb, the more you see it turns out. The more down you go, the more accurate you see it is. Every word is measured. They say, there's a story, I don't know if it's true, but they say that there was a group of Kabbalistic sages who got together to write the commentary, on the whole Talmud. So they got together to write this Kabbalistic commentary explaining the Talmud on Kabbalistic grounds. And they finished this whole thing and it was enormous, it was much too long. So they decided to see if they could cut it in half. So they sat down and they pared it down to its absolute minimum. And it was still much too long. So they decided to concentrate the whole Kabbalistic wisdom into even more compressed, and then they did it again, and they did it again. And finally they ended up with Rashi. That's what they say. Rashi wrote a commentary that goes beyond words. And by the way, how did Rashi do it? You think Rashi had an automatic word processor that he typed in a word in the Gemara and it sprayed out for him a whole vomit of information like today? That isn't what Rashi did. Rashi did it in medieval France. Rashi lived in Troyes, in France, during the Crusades. You have to understand that. That means this man sat at a table in a little room, turning out this work that nobody can fathom how it could have been fitted into a lifetime, and you can check it out yourself. He wrote it in a phase of Jewish history where a Jew's life was worth less than nothing. When Rashi put his head out of the door to try and find a minion, right, he was lucky to make it home alive. There were crusaders, knights, riding up and down in the street outside his home, looking for Jews to butcher. That's what he lived through. He lived through years of that. That's what his life was. Right? And in the midst of that, he turned out Rashi. What an understanding, what a feat that is. Yes, if you want to get some vague idea, imagine it's around the 25th of next month, right, in this place, and you've got a massive TV set on the table in front of you, and it's blasting out this pageantry that they have at that time. You know I'm talking about? These songs and things that they sing. Turn it up to full volume, and try to write a reasonable commentary on anything. Yeah? That's what he was going, except it wasn't just a medium that was doing it. He had people trying to kill him, and he said that. Yeah. And the Uri says that anybody, that's the generation of the Rishonim. When you go back to the Goyim, who lived in the 7th, 8th, 9th century, from the 5th to the 9th century, the Rishonim speak about them in those terms. People like Rashi and the Ramban, they speak about the Goyim, who the preceding era, in terms like they couldn't fathom their greatness. Whenever they wish to disagree, whenever they can't understand anything of the Goyim, they write as follows: if it weren't for the poverty of my intellect, I would have asked the following question. That's what they say. But since he was a God and I'm a nothing compared to him, and every word is measured and true, I'm not even going to bother. That's how they talk about the Goyim. And the Goyim compared to the Achonim, compared to the Amiroim who wrote the Gemara, not even started. That's less than 2,000 years ago. And here he says anybody mentioned in Talmud had the capacity to revive the dead. The Gemara is full of it, by the way. The Gemara is full of documented stories of Tanoim, at least, who revived the dead without any problem. Much more miracles even than in Tanakh. It wasn't a problem. Split rivers, revived the dead, or lit vinegar, whatever you want. Gemara is full of it. And they were, what we described up to now, is exponential leap. They weren't even non-starters compared to the Nevi'im, compared to the generation of prophecy, compared to the generation of Anshei Knesset HaGedola, who lived a few hundred years before them, right, in which Ezra and Nehemiah lived, who saw the tail end of prophecy. The mystics say that if you compare that generation to one generation before when the last prophet was alive, it was like a world with a light on and a world with a light off. Because when prophecy ended, the world went completely dark and all wisdom was lost. They described the transition from prophecy to the generation after prophecy, that there was nothing left at all. They describe the level of people walking around in these generations. The mystics call us people who have the life force in us of what's called Havla de Garmi. You might find this embarrassing, but Havla de Garmi is the amount of human life force that invests a pile of dried bones. If you have a pile of dried human bones, the amount of intelligent, spiritual human life in those dry bones is called the Havla de Garmi. That's what we look like compared to people of a generation that we call human. That means, you follow what that means? That means if Moshe Rabbeinu walked in now, even a much lesser man than Moshe Rabbeinu, if Yahushua walked in now, or much later generations, if a Tana, if a Novi, if Yecheskel, if one of the Novim walked in now, you would see a room full of faint, powdery, dried bones. Right? If you're lucky, you'd make out a shape of a bone here and there, compared to a shining example of what a human being should be. And that's a vast understatement, a vast understatement. Again, you don't have to take it from me. This is what we understand. This is Jewish tradition. Check it out. Corroborate it for yourself. Read what they wrote. Study their writings. Get in contact with it and try and reawaken some of this consciousness. And it goes on. The further back you go, the higher it becomes. Mm-hmm. We have a clear understanding that if Moshe Rabbeinu would walk into this room, we would dissolve. We would absolutely dissolve. We would disappear in a pile of ash. Yep. We know that the people of his generation couldn't stand to look at him. You remember that? There's such a light, such an intense, burning light shining from his face that he had a mask for the people of his generation who'd witnessed the giving of the Torah. The people who stood at Sinai couldn't look at his face. Can you imagine if he walked in here? The place would be fried. That, all that would be left would be a small wisp of a bad smell. That's what the mystics say. That's all. Now, that's who we're talking about. That's the kind of people we're talking about. So when you get back to the times of the Torah, Chumash, Tanakh, you're talking about people that, here's Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is told to go and sacrifice his son. You have to understand this. You know, you see, you've got this conflict in your mind. We have this conflict because Avraham Avinu lived about 4,000 years ago, thereabouts. So if you look in secular history, that's when people were roaming the plains with bones, bits of bone that they hacked out of animals, and then they were bashing each other to pieces. That's what secular history tells you. So you think that Avraham Avinu was sort of a man, he's had a rough sandals and a bit of a coarse old sort of robe, you know, and he had this primitive sort of conception of religion. Now understand that an idea that is so trite that it's an insult to a Jew to even begin to think that way. Here's this man of shining spiritual greatness that we can't begin to conceive what he looks like. There are people who say, there are educators who say, that it's forbidden for a person to write a book for children, a Torah book for children, and draw pictures of the characters. And what a travesty! They write a book about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, they draw you a picture of a naked man and woman, right, who don't even look that attractive in today's terms. Right? That's what they do. Sort of a bit of a snake curled around one of them and a couple of fig leaves. And we have a tradition that Adam Orishan was so incandescent with spirituality that you couldn't see his body. In the mystical writings it says that if you looked at him, he was so incandescent with neshama that you couldn't see the body. You had to shield your eyes against the light of the neshama to make out a wisp of a body somewhere. If you want an example, it's exactly like we are today, the other way around. Today, if you look at a human being, you see a lump of meat, so just a piece of steak. If you want to see the neshama inside, you have to look very, very, very deeply to see anything alive about a human being. You want to see a neshama? You won't see a neshama. You want to see a soul inside a human being? You won't see that. The mystic said, you see a glow on the face, maybe. If you're lucky, if you know how to look at it, you can see a glow on the face and erect posture. That's what the mystic. But apart from that, nothing. But Adam Rishon was exactly the opposite. You couldn't see the body, he was so incandescent with Kedusha. They draw you a picture of a man and a woman. If there's any negative education, that's got to be it. Here's Avraham Avinu in that generation. He's asked to go and sacrifice his son. And he does it as an act of love. He doesn't understand it. It goes everything he's taught. That was the test. That was exactly the test. He withstood all the 9 tests previously without any problem. Being thrown into fire for his belief wasn't a problem at all. Yeah? We had people 50 years ago who walked into a fire singing and dancing. Singing in ecstasy, we saw that. So for him to be thrown into a fire for his belief in Hashem, after Hashem had been revealed to him, actually it was before Hashem openly revealed himself, but for him it was no problem at all, I can assure you. It was a minor test. But to kill his son, that went against the previous instruction that he had from the same source, that's confusing. Hashem told him, this son will be the forebear of the Jewish people, and from him will arise a great nation. And then he says, shaft him against everything that he's believed and taught, against his whole understanding of what Hashem means and what he is. Well, that's a test. What happens? He lives up to the test with love. What does it mean with love? That means he, despite his love for his son, despite his love, don't think it's because he didn't feel anything for his son. If anybody ever loved the son, it was that man. Well, the son born when he was 100 years old, on his way out of life already, that's how he felt. And a son was born to him who was going to be the fulfillment of everything he stood for. If anybody ever loved the son, it was he. And he was told to shaft him, cold-bloodedly lay him down on a thing and murder him. So they walked together. And you read that parasha, if it doesn't make you cry, I don't know what will. It says they walked together. When Yitzchak found out what was happening to him, it says they walked together again. Yitzchak found out that he was about to be sacrificed. He said to his father, Dad, tie my hands. Because in case when you lift the knife, I might flinch. And first of all, I might hurt you. I might flinch and hurt you. So tie me up. And not only might I hurt you, but in case I flinch and you do an unkosher shchita, you'll make a move in me. And I won't be a kosher korban. I won't be a valid sacrifice. And we've got to do this right. So Avraham tied him up. That's how the two of them were. Avram's about to shecht him, and as he lifts the knife, he hears a voice. Right? A voice says, Avram, Avram, don't touch the boy. Al tishlach yad ka'alana. Don't set your hand. Al tas loy ma'uma. And don't do anything to him. Don't set your hand to him, and don't do anything. So the Mephoshim say, why two instructions? Don't kill him, and don't do anything to him. Why two? Because you know what happens. When Hashem said, Avram, don't kill him, Avram says, Hashem, please! I want to do this thing for you. Don't remind me this mitzvah. Could you imagine such a thing? He's just been given the opportunity to save his son's life. And he begs. And Hashem says, I don't want to do this. Hashem, just a drop of blood. At least let me draw a drop of blood that I'll show the world. I'll put into the Jewish people this power of self-sacrifice. Greater than self-sacrifice. Easy to sacrifice yourself. Sacrifice a child? That's just about impossible. And Hashem said, no, I don't want a drop of blood. That's the level they want. It says when... Oh, I don't want to make all shit, we'll never get to the problem. I'll give one or two more examples. Maybe next year we'll have to carry on, I don't know. It says that when Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim, I'm just picking one or two examples, and at the end of the discussion, you have to go through Torah and understand it correctly. When Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim to meet his son Yosef, he hadn't seen Joseph for 22 years. Remember the story? Joseph had been away for 22 years, he was the ruler of Egypt. Yaakov went down to meet this boy whom he hadn't seen for 22 years. He'd mourned actively for this boy for 22 years. The mystics say that his mourning was as intense as a normal mourner is in the first week. His mourning was that intense for 22 years. Why? Because the normal mourning of a mourner gets less with time, because the neshama of the person that you're mourning for goes to easier levels all the time. So it takes more, it sucks out less of agony from you. But in Yosef's case, he wasn't dead. So there was no pathway of the neshama. So Yaakov never had the relief. He never sensed the relief of that, and he mourned like a new mourner for 22 years. What happened? When he went down to meet him, first of all, I'm sure you're all familiar with the story that he didn't respond. When Yosef hugged him and embraced him, Yaakov didn't respond at all. Why? Because he was saying Shema. Saying Shema, that's the moment he chose to say Shema. Why say Shema then? He had all day to say Shema. No, he wanted to sanctify the most precious moment in his life. He's about to meet, and don't think it's because he didn't love his son. It's because he loved his son that much that he wanted to sanctify to Hashem. That's the moment to say Shema. You've got to understand how these people thought. Then it says this, 17 years later, it says Yaakov died. Yosef came into the room and it says he kissed him. When his father died, it says he kissed him. So Mephoshim says, you know why it says that? Because for 17 years he never let Yosef kiss him. The son, for whom he'd mourned for 22 years, on whom he pinned all his hopes for the Jewish people, he never let that boy kiss him until he couldn't help it anymore, he was dead. Why? Says him a fortune like this. Because when Yosef was 17 years old, he was living in Mitzrayim, and he lived in the house of a man called Potiphar. And Potiphar's wife, who was a very seductive lady, tried to seduce this 17-year-old boy with every means at her disposal, and she knew exactly how. For a year, without letting up, she tried to seduce this young boy of 17. And she tried to seduce him, you must understand, not with physical attraction. That was the least of it. A Yosef, who becomes the forefather of the Jewish, one of the forefathers, he wasn't be attracted, I can assure you, by something that they pin up on the wall today. That wasn't what attracted him. He had a prophetic vision that out of the two of them would come two of the tribes of Israel. That was a temptation. He had a prophetic vision, and so did she, that out of the two of them would come two tribes of Israel. Only the relationship happens to be forbidden. But listen, you've got to weigh it up. Now that's a temptation, and in fact she was right. Because what happened? Ultimately what happened was, her daughter married Yosef, and the two of them had two children, Ephraim and Manasseh. But they didn't know at the time. He didn't know it would be fulfilled in that way. All he knew is that out of the two of them would come great offspring. So she had him tempted on every level, spiritual, physical, every level, and he resisted. The version says this. At the end of a year, after he had resisted her temptations for a year, once he was alone in the house with her, and she tried very, very strongly to seduce him, and for an instant he considered doing it. What it says. For one second he considered sinning with her. And as he considered it, he saw his father's face at the window. An image, a vision of his father's face appeared at the window, and when he saw that vision of going back to his senses, why he merited that is another story, and he ran out of the house. She grabbed his clothing to try and hold him back. He ran out naked, knowing exactly what it would mean. He didn't go back. He was much stronger than she was. He could have gone back to force his clothes, but he didn't want to risk it. He didn't know he'd be saved again. He chose to run out naked and be accused by her, just as he was, and his life almost was cost, and he spent 12 years in jail because of that. The misery. That's what happens to him. The Mephoshim say this, the deeper commentary say this. When Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim and he saw his son, that he hadn't seen for 22 years. He parted from him when the boy was 17. And he hadn't seen him for 22 years. The first thing he saw when he lifted his face, that this was the face of a man who had once had a thought that crossed his mind of sinning with a woman. And such a man, he wouldn't let kiss him. Remember that? This boy, who'd never made a mistake in his life. Maybe when he was 16 he made a mistake. He said something wrong about his brothers, maybe. But if yes, that was the only mistake he ever made. And in fact he was justified later. He was exonerated later. If he ever made a mistake, it was once the thought of sinning with a woman in a physical way crossed his mind. When Yaakov perceived that just by looking at his face, he wouldn't let him kiss him. Not until he was dead. Can't understand the perfection, the level of people that we're talking about. And it goes on and on and on. If you think there's a case in the Talmud, there's a case in the Gemara of two Kohanim who who were running up the Kibbutz, they were running up to do the Avodah on the Mizbeach, and one of them was fatally stabbed. One of the Kohanim was fatally stabbed. One young Kohen, a young man, very young man, was bleeding to death in the Beit HaMikdash. Right? A Kohen. He'd been running up to do the Avodah, someone stabbed him, and he lay bleeding to death. His father ran over. His father ran over to him and he said, quickly, he's still alive, let's get him out of here and save the Kedusha of the Beit HaMikdash. Because if there's too much mace in the Beit HaMikdash, if a person dies in the Beit HaMikdash, it's a terrible tumor for the Beit HaMikdash. So in the Mephoshim will say, there's two possibilities in such a situation. Either this man felt nothing for his son, or he felt a great deal for the Beit HaMikdash. For Kedusha, for Hashem. But I start to understand these things. We don't have time. There's much, much, much more. That's only the beginning. I'll show you every incident in Torah. Is only told to us because it's an act of perfection. The Torah says, Avraham Avinu lifted his eyes. You know that? It says, Vayisas Eina Vaya. He lifted his eyes and saw. Every dot in Torah, the cosmic reality depends on. If the Torah bothers to tell you that he lifted his eyes, it means it was a cosmic event. He lifted his eyes with such control that the universe was never the same again. That's what we're talking about in Torah. Now, if that's true, how did they do such terrible things? These people at this level of perfection, how did they do such crude and lowly things? What did they do? Let's take some of them. The generation of the desert. They made a golden calf. Says it openly. They bowed down, they worshipped a piece of gold. This generation, they saw Hashem, they stood at Sinai, right? They witnessed the revelation. That means personally, they witnessed Hashem appear to them. A short time later, 40 days later to be exact, they panicked for certain reasons, they made a piece of gold, they bowed down to a piece of gold. Is there any way to understand that? I promise you, if I'd seen Hashem, when Hashem appeared to me and said, "Oh, Kib, I'd like you to do this and this, so I've got 10 things that I want to discuss with you, and I'd like you to do this and this for me," I promise you, 40 days later, I wouldn't bow down to a piece of God. And if yes, I must be schizophrenic. You agree with me? There's no way to understand that. What is going? And if that's what they did, I don't want to be descended from such people. I'm not proud to be descended from people who did that. People who made a piece of gold and bowed down to it, maybe that's one thing. But they have met Hashem personally, and then a short time later do that? What were they thinking? You with me? Reuben. It says that when Yaakov lost his wife, Rachel, it says that Reuben committed a sin with his father's wife. That's what it says. And the words are very dangerously close to being explicitly a statement that he had a physical, intimate relationship with his father's wife. Reuben, one of the 12 tribes, people of such perfection that they were able to form Klal Yisrael. You know, we say that when Abraham had two sons, one of them was Ishmael, he wasn't perfect. Although he did tshuva in the end, and he came very close. But because he was left a little bit somewhere, he was thrown out. Thrown out of the house with his mother. Nothing to do with the Jewish people anymore. The Torah doesn't mince its words with people who commit. Huh? Next generation, you had an Esav. Esav didn't make it. Esav failed. Reuben? Reuben's not regarded as somebody who failed. He's one of the perfect 12 tribes. And it says he committed such a sin. A man on such a level of greatness, such a crude, who would do such a thing? Who would do such a thing? It says that when Joshua, I'm just picking a few examples, we have to discuss them all in great detail, one at a time, we'll have to go through each of them in great detail. Joshua, it says when he took the people into Israel, there was a rule that when they conquered the land, they weren't allowed to loot. Right? When they conquered Jericho, it says that they weren't allowed to loot. The next battle, the battle of Ai, it says the Jewish people lost and many were lost. Many people were destroyed. It came out that they had looted. And it's a nice thing. You stole, you looted, you lied, you covered up. Words of very strong casting. How did they do such a thing? People had witnessed Hashem bring them all this way. They'd experienced the miracle of living 40 years in the desert. And they were so crude as to disobey blatantly. You follow? Ezra. Ezra lived at the time of the Great Assembly. Ezra lived in the generation, he saw prophets. Ezra lived in the generation of Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi, the last three prophets. When Ezra brought the Jewish people back to build the second temple, that means the Jewish people were on a level that they could build the Beit HaMikdash. They could build the temples, you know what kind of a level that is? It says that he couldn't get them back, you know why? Because the men had intermarried. The Jewish men had intermarried the Babylonian women. We think today intermarriage is a problem because we've got no Jewish consciousness and the schools aren't giving enough Judaism and so forth, we're going downhill. But in that generation, these people were considered fitting to build a Beit HaMikdash, and when he tried to bring them back, they were intermarried with Babylonian women, one of the most serious crimes in Jewish life. Now, it says that a person who has a sexual relationship with a non-Jewish woman, he can't be saved from Gehenna. Avraham Avinu can't pull him out of Gehenna because he can't recognize him. So you panic. Depends on your level of knowledge and responsibility and so on. But that, they certainly knew. They knew. That generation, if anybody knew what it meant, they knew. And it says they married non-Jewish women? How did they do such a thing? King David. King David is a man that says clearly made only two mistakes in his life. That's not a bad record. That's not bad. I wish I'd only made two mistakes in my life. But one of them was some mistake. He took a man, he craved his wife, saw his wife bathing at night, had the man killed and committed adultery with her. It says that. But that's a heavy mistake. And so it goes on and on and on and on, and we have to understand the subject. Now, you agree with me? It's a problem. Somebody? If it's not a problem, I'll go home. Now, what we have to understand is this. What we want to come out with this evening is an understanding, a resolution of the subject. But we're going to need more than that. We're going to need to understand how their greatness was their greatness, and it wasn't studied at all by these things. How the sins, what these sins were. And we can't whitewash the subject. We can't whitewash it and say, well, they weren't really sins. Actually, it wasn't the way it seemed. We can't do that because it's enough as it was. The words of Pharaoh have to be true in every single way. You follow me? It's just not good enough if I tell you, well, David didn't really commit the sin because actually it wasn't that bad. It's a bit of hyperbole, a bit of exaggeration. I can't do that because if you open the Tanakh, it says exactly what he did. And if you want to whitewash the Jewish people and say that the Jewish people are people of greatness and the average level of the Jewish people throughout the generations has been incredibly great, open Tanakh anywhere. Open any of the Levim, it doesn't say that. It says we're the lowliest of people. We're an unfaithful wife. We betrayed Hashem. Traitorous, harlotry, all kind of terrible things, but hardly a word of praise. Hardly a word of praise, you know. And of course, the people who do that are the non-Jews. The non-Jewish nation, they do it all the time. You know, that's part of Christian dogma. Part of Christian doctrine is that they're the chosen people. I don't know if you're aware of this. Part of Christian dogma is that we were the chosen people. They admit that. We were the chosen people. But the age of what they call the age of wrath, of anger, gave way to what they call the age of grace, which is now what we're in. And in the age of grace, the real chosen people shone their light forth, and they became the chosen people, Hashem's real chosen beloved ones. Why? Why? Where did they get this from? Because we betrayed Hashem. Why did he give us up? And what did they do about all the promises in the Old Testament that say they'll never give us up? Now Hashem makes a promise, he means it. So how did he give us up and choose them? Where do they well, you know where they get it from? Tanakh, open up any place. It says exactly like them. It says, you people betrayed me. I trusted you and you betrayed me. That's what it says. You let me down. You left me. You betrayed me. You're wanton harlotry. You left me. Says it all over. So they've got a very good source. Their source is us. They prove it from our holy writings. You follow? Now, let's try and understand. So we have a tough problem here. We have to understand what the sins were. These people's greatness we cannot touch. We have to understand their greatness without saying, well, they failed a bit. We can't say that. And then we have to understand how they did such terrible things. And I'm going to tell you that the terrible things they did were acts of perfection. What they did is inconceivable. It's impossible to find what was wrong with it. But then I'm going to have to explain to you that it doesn't say that in Tanakh. I mean, that's going to have to be true. We've got an enormous problem on our hands. But you'll see it's an obvious, once it's clear, once you've thought about it, you'll see it couldn't be any other way. It's obvious, the fundamental, it's the core of Judaism, the core of Torah, and it has to be expressed this way, you'll see clearly. The concept is as follows. First, let's say the principle. Let's try and explain the principle, and then let's try and go through its applications and understand it. You with me so far? You're not going to enjoy the answer unless you've got the problem. The principle is as follows. The people that we're talking about were people very, very, very close to perfection. The mistakes they made were a tiny, tiny deviation from perfection. An imperceptible deviation from perfection. That's the principle. Now, why does the Tanakh say that they failed so miserably? Why does it put it in such gross and graphic terms? Why does it, the Tanakh doesn't say they failed almost imperceptibly. The Tanakh says they failed miserably. Why? Concept number two. Concept number two is, your failure is relative to you, not relative to some outside standard. When you're a failure or a success, you're a failure or success relative to your potential, not relative to mine. Whether you succeed or fail depends on what you could have done. You follow? It's only this crazy system that takes children into school and never compares them against each other. You ruin children for life that way. We live in a system where we don't judge a child for what he's capable of and reward him if he does the best that he could do. We don't do that. We ask the child, what did you get and what did other kids get in the class? So the child did his best. He did his best. He extended himself and he did great. And he came near the bottom of the class. And the child made to feel like he's a failure. That's a terribly cruel system. That's completely against Jewish education. That's terrible. Nobody should go to school like that.
Sorry about this. People who might be forced into such situations.
But that's how it is. Now, how do you judge a child accurately? And it's the only way to look at it, Julian. You think about it for a minute, you see it makes sense. You compare a person to what he's capable of. Like I've often said before, we often use this example. You have two children in a home, in a house. The one is a mathematical genius, okay? The one is such a mathematical genius that he never gets anything wrong, okay? He never fails, he never drops a mark ever in his whole history at school. He's so far above the level, he never gets anything wrong. He's got a young brother, he's got a brother at home, who always gets 50%. This child does his utmost and he never gets more than 50. He never has ever got more than 50. One day they come home after a test. The child who gets 99 came home with 100, came home with 99. The child who normally gets 50 came home with 55. What happens? For the kid who normally gets 50, they make a party. Correct? For the kid who gets 99, they give him a thrashing. The father gives him a beating. Correct? Why? Because you failed. You are capable of 100%. You were careless. You were silly. You were careless. You didn't care about your record. You didn't live up to your level of expertise. You failed. You are a failure. At that moment, is it correct or not? But the child who gets 50, extended himself beyond all expectation, got 55, that's a tremendous success. Are you with me? But it's obvious. Of course, in the mystical dimension, we say that a person in the next world is judged exactly this way. In the next world, they don't say, why weren't you like him? They don't ask you why you weren't like Moshe Rabbeinu. You weren't supposed to be. They ask you, why weren't you like you? And that's a tough question to answer. They show you in the next world what you could have been. They don't show you somebody else. They just show you a picture, and you know it, by the way. You know it. You have a little bit of an inkling of what your powers are. Sometimes when you've really been pushed by a bit of adrenaline, or a bit of some of the lower senses, the lower emotions, or something totally unworthy, but you got a bit stimulated, you pull out the stops and you turn out something. I'm sure everybody's felt that. Well, they show you what you would have looked like if you'd have done that all the time. And you look very different from that. But that's what they do. They compare you. That's the principle. You compare them. Now. These people did things that were 99.999%. That's what they should have been. But these are people capable of 100. And when somebody's capable of 100, and he's been enshrined in Torah that way, and David HaMelech is capable of 100, and he's teaching the world 100%, and it's going to be written down in Torah, and it's going to be in my genes, and the whole future of the world is going to be dependent on what he does. The Jewish people are going to look that way. The Mashiach is going to come out because of that. You can't afford to have 0.0001 of an error. You can't afford that. He was put in that position. He was given his tremendous ability because he was capable of never dropping 0.0001%. So when he drops that, he's a failure. He's a total failure. He deserves to be castigated as strongly as a lower person who failed much worse. You follow me? And the Torah tells it like it is. The Torah is not writing to some idiot out there who's not capable of anything. The Torah is speaking to 100% people. When you write a letter, right? When you speak in private, you take a child and you speak in private to him about having got 95 instead of 100 when he should have got 100. You speak criticism. You don't tell him that he did very well according to some idiot out there who never gets more than 20. That's not how you do it. You compare him to himself. And the words that you give him are words of criticism. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. If he fell, the Torah is speaking to us, not speaking to anybody out there. The Torah is a personal, private letter. It wasn't written for anybody else. But Hashem wants his people to be perfect. He tells it like it is. Are you with me? So now with this principle, let's try and understand a few details. First of all, let's deal with one thing that can be thrown out immediately. When the non-Jews come to us and say, you miserable failures, let's understand this very deeply. When the non-Jewish world, the Christian world, they come to us and they say, we are the chosen people. You know why we're the chosen people? Because you people failed. You people failed, and it says so. The chutzpah of this. You have to understand what that means. The situation is like this. Some of them, what should say? They say it's like a father who takes a child that he loves. And this child always is perfect. The child never ever makes a mistake. The child has got such good meters. He always behaves correctly. This child once was disrespectful to somebody. Once he made a mistake. But to the child, he made a mistake. So the father gives him a beating. A beating. He wants the child to be perfect. He shows him exactly what he feels about somebody who falls some lout from the street. A crude, brutish lout who's never done anything in his life. Capable of nothing. Happens to walk in while the father's busy beating his child. So he sees what's going on. He gives the kid a kick. This lout from the street, he gives the child a kick. So the father turns to him and says, what are you doing? He said, well, you're doing it, aren't you? But the father will take him apart. When the time comes, the father will turn to this lout and he'll tear him apart. The father, I'm beating this child because I love him. You're not worth being spoken to. Nobody's speaking to you. You follow me? And I'm speaking to this child with castigation and criticism because he's capable of perfection. And I'm devoting my life to perfecting this child. But nobody bothers speaking to you. What a chutzpah. You follow what's going on here? They walk in from the outside, people who failed from the beginning, people who didn't live up to the challenge of Torah, never even tried the challenge of Torah. Now, it says at Sinai, we accepted and they turned away. They walk in now and say that we blew it, and they're the chosen people, and the evidence is that Hashem's speaking to us like this. Do you hear how pathetic it is? Are you with me? The Torah is a love letter between Hashem and us. It's a letter between a father and a son that he loves very much. And when you write to a child, you've got a child away in yeshiva someplace, you don't write just wonderful words of praise. You want to stimulate the child to do the best that he can. Occasionally a word of praise. Occasionally. So we have a word of praise here and there. It says in the Novi, Zachati la chesed nu'orai, I will always remember to you the kindness of your youth. This is Hashem saying about us. Ahavas kulotayach, the love of your bridal days when you got married to me. Like we are the young bride of Hashem. Lechdeich acharai b'midbar, when you walked after me in the desert, be'eretz lozra, in a land unsown. I'll never forget that. That's what Hashem says. My love for you is such, I'll never forget what you did for me, how you followed me into a place of desolation. But we have comments like that to keep us going. And of course, and he has to reach perfection at his own level, as you said before. He has to live up to his perfection. It's a different system. It's within Torah also. It's not tonight's subject. Now, is the principle clear? That's the principle. Now let's try and see its application. Now what we have to do is apply this principle in such a way that we see some of the sins, we see what they were, we see that it's fair to call them such gross sins. In other words, you take a David HaMelech, you take the generation of the desert that worshipped the golden calf, and you say that they failed in very, very crude terms. Alright, understand. Understand, you're telling me that at their level they failed. Not at my level, at their level they failed. But to say that they worshipped the golden calf, one second. You told me that they failed almost imperceptibly. But it doesn't say that. First of all, it doesn't say almost imperceptibly. Alright, you've explained that to me. But look what they did. We're going to have to grapple with that still, right? Look what they did. They worshipped a piece of gold. How am I going to get around that one? Or it says David. He had a man killed and took his wife, adultery. It says that. Or Reuben. He had an intimate relationship with his father's wife. And it says that. So how are we going to... Are you following me? Now, let's understand. Let's understand carefully. I don't think we may have to finish the subject. Let's just... Perhaps we'll do it in two parts. Let's just clarify this principle and we'll try and interest him to continue with it. Rav Miller from Gateway gives the most wonderful examples of what this principle looks like from the outside, okay? He wants to show you a marshal, an analogy, how you could understand what it means to fail at somebody's level of greatness, okay? And fail at somebody's level of loneliness, and have the same words applied to both, and mean different things for... That's our problem now. And when it says they failed and did that very thing wrong, it has to mean it literally. And yet still be understood in terms of what we said before. That's our problem. But listen to the answer. Listen to his marshal. It's so such a powerful and such a beautiful marshal. It makes it so clear. This is the principle we'll need, and I'll explain it, and then we'll try and see if we can apply it, if we have time or next time. As follows. He gives the following marshal. Imagine, beautiful scenario, such a gift to be able to have such an example. He says this. Imagine that a young boy of 16 leaves school and he goes to look for a job. And he gets a job working for Shell Oil. That's a multi-million dollar petroleum company, right? And he gets a job. What's his job? He's a tea boy on the ground floor of Shell Oil. He makes tea, he posts the letters. His highest level of responsibility is like which mailbox he's going to post the letters in today, right? As opposed to yesterday. That's his most enormous decision he has to make. That's his job. He works for Shell Oil, that's what he does. After he's been there for a few months, he sees in the newspaper a headline. Shell Oil decides to invest $75 million prospecting for oil in Venezuela. That's what he sees. As he sees the headline, he says, they're crazy, they'll lose all the money. Crazy, it's an unstable place, they'll lose all the money, they should never do it. That's what he says. Time goes by. Shell Oil invests $75 million in Venezuela. 3 weeks later, there's a coup in Venezuela. All assets are nationalized, and Shell Oil lose exactly $75 million. And it makes the headlines. Shell Oil loses $75 million in Israel. He sees the headlines. I told you, he says. They were fools to go in. They should have listened to me. The minister says the following thing. Examine that situation carefully. What happened? Shell Oil decided to invest $75 million. You know why? Because there was a very big profit that could have been made. You know why Shell Oil decided to invest all that money? Because they up in the boardroom, this chap works on the ground floor, up in the boardroom of Shell Oil, the top brains in that multi-million dollar international company got together and sat around the boardroom, and they sat through the night, and they sat night after night, pondering the decision to invest all that money in Venezuela. And they're the top geological experts in the world testifying in front of them. And they're the top financial experts in the world testifying. And the top military experts and the top political experts in the world they pay to come and give the best, most accurate information. And after weeks and weeks of work, they put together the total situation at that level, at that executive administrative level, that the risk was worth it. They knew it was an unstable place. They knew the risks. They knew the geological risks and the political. They knew all the risks, and they decided that business is like risk. If you don't take risks, you don't make it. The prize is worth it, and they risk the money. What happened? What happened? They were wrong. They were wrong. They lost the money. They lost it. Something went wrong. One of the risk factors that they taken into account, right, that they decided was worth going for, was against them, and they lost the money. Now, there are two ways to look at that situation. From the people in the boardroom, let's be honest about it. Were they wrong? Absolutely. They were wrong. There's no question about it. They were completely wrong. And they lost all their money. They didn't lose a couple of cents. They lost everything. They were exactly as wrong as the tea boy on the bottom said. Is that correct? He was completely right. They thought they should have listened to him. He was completely right. Exactly every word he said was correct. You follow me? But the chutzpah, you follow? The chutzpah of this idiot. He doesn't know any, understand anything about anything. And he says they should. You follow what's going on here? That's how you have to understand the grace of Pinnah. When David HaMelech did something, David HaMelech had very, very great stakes in here. David HaMelech, when he saw Bathsheba, it says in Mephoshim, he had a prophetic insight, Ruach HaKodesh, that out of the two of them would come Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, who's the father of the Mashiach. That's not bad. And Takei came out of him. David wasn't wrong about that. He wasn't wrong. There were enormous stakes in hand over here. You follow me? The people who did these things, here they were once people who had nothing better to do than fool around with crude and coarse avails. There's tremendous, tremendous cosmic amount at stake. And the risk was worth it. The place they failed was so subtle that you couldn't even grasp it. And they were, in the end, what happened? They were wrong. No question. Not whitewashing anything. They were absolutely wrong. They were just as wrong as Tanakh said. And at their level of greatness, they should have done better. At that executive level, at that level of administrative expertise, they should have done better. And Shaul wouldn't make that same mistake next time. You follow me? David HaMelech was wrong, no question about it. Tanakh doesn't whitewash what he did. But the chutzpah to understand him like you, that's what's the problem. He failed at that level. At his level of greatness, he shouldn't have done that. He shouldn't have done what he did with Bathsheba, even though when we see what was wrong about it, it's almost impossible to grasp what was wrong. It wasn't adultery, it wasn't murder, there's nothing like it, it didn't begin to be like that. But at his level of greatness, it was as bad as if a coarse, crude gutter snipe would have done such a lowly thing. And for him, it was that crime. It was that crime. So what have we, let's just summarize at this point. What do we have? The sins were exactly as described. No whitewashing. Exactly as described. As bad, exactly as bad. Details, exactly the details. You follow me? But at their level of greatness. Now the chutzpah to say that I wouldn't have done such a thing. You follow what we're driving at? The Gemara says the following thing. The Gemara takes these examples, the Gemara in Shabbos, and it says this. The Gemara says, Kola Oymer, so David Chata, Einoi Ela Toye. Anybody who says that David sinned is making a mistake. The Gemara says this. The Gemara says, anybody who says Reuben sinned is making a mistake. The Gemara says this. You know, we are Torah Shabbat there. We are the Talmud. We're not the Tanakh. We are not the written law. The written law is available to all nations. The written law is not what makes you a Jew. It's the intricate, intrinsic, internal understanding of Torah Shabbat there. That Torah that's written on the heart and mind of the Talmidei Chachamim of Kol Yisrael, that's what makes us Jewish. Not what you can read in Bible. Bible isn't Jewish. Bible you can have in any language you want and they have. That's not what makes you Jewish. I'm sorry to tell you that. Now, Tanakh is only as understood through the eyes of Talmud. And when you understand it that way, you'll see there's no other way to understand it. That's what makes us Jewish. And the Gemara says that anybody who says that David sinned is making a mistake. Anybody who says Reuben sinned is making a mistake. That's what it says. Let's understand. What's the final piece we have to fit? I want to spend a few more minutes. Is that okay? A few more minutes. The final piece we have to slot into the puzzle is this. We've understood now that there are levels, relative levels of greatness. We've understood that you're held accountable at your level, and the Jewish level, Jewish people's level is a level of perfection. I've understood that. They failed at their level, I understood. But what you have to still explain is, But they did what the words say, such crude things. Now that still has to be understood. You know what I mean? And it has to be that it's true, and yet it has to be that it's only that very sin at their level. That still needs to be explained. Are you with me? That's the last piece of the puzzle to be slotted in. Correct? Got the head for it? As follows. The only way to answer this, unfortunately or fortunately, is to take each sin, take each example. We're not definitely not going to be able to do that, but perhaps we'll just choose one or two to illustrate the principle. You have to take each sin, see exactly what happened, according to what the Talmud says, and in many cases, by the way, you don't even have to look into it. In many cases, if you just look carefully at the words themselves in Tanakh, it's obvious from the words, you'll see that to find a mistake over there is almost impossible. Let's try. And the Gemara searches, by the way, the Gemara searches for a lengthy discussion, trying to find what did David do wrong. Remember last week we discussed it, she was divorced already. Who wasn't here last week? We discussed it in detail last week. Bathsheba was divorced already. We had all the soldiers in David's army divorced their wives before they went to battle. Conditional divorce, so that if they never reappeared, the wives wouldn't be adulterous and prohibited from remarrying. So she was divorced already. Uriah wasn't killed by David. He had an immediate death sentence on him already active for disobeying the king. And instead of executing him summarily on the spot, David allowed him to die in battle. Exactly the opposite, remember this. So when you're finished with all this information, say, what did he do wrong? So what did he do wrong? He saw Bathsheba. He had a very strong craving for a woman whom he understood would be a woman together with whom would come out King Solomon. Right? And the Mashiach would be born from this union. That's what he saw. Right? Not a bad motivation for a marriage. And that's what happened. Proving that he was correct. He was right about that. Uriah, her husband, had a death sentence. Instead of killing him, David allowed for him to die honorably in battle. Nothing wrong with that. She was divorced already when he took her. And he married a divorced woman. What's the problem? What did he do wrong? It says he committed adultery, had a man killed and committed. Roshim said this. For him, that's what it was. Because it smacked. He shouldn't have done that. At his level of perfection, which it was a test, there's no deal. He shouldn't have done it that way. Do you follow me? That it could even appear to be that way. You follow? The divorce, after all, was a technical divorce. You follow? It's a valid divorce. But it was a technical, conditional divorce that soldiers gave to their wives in case they wouldn't come back. So it's valid, technically. You follow me? But in the spirit of the thing, there's something that's not quite right. You follow? He had him killed in battle, right? He had him killed. He did have him killed at that time, right? Although he was entitled to. But it was suspiciously close to marrying his wife. You follow what's going on here? That means at his level of greatness and what it would look like and what it would be recorded as in Tanakh, he should have held on. Should have waited. He shouldn't have done it that way. You follow? Which means that he really did those things, but applied only to a man of his greatness. Let's take another example. That's what we discussed last week. I'll give you another example. It says when the Jews walked in the desert, when they followed Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert, it says they walked in the desert without water. Do you remember this? One of the 10 times they failed in the desert, Misuni Zeh Eser Pomim, you tested me these 10 times. 10 times on their travel through the desert they failed. They tested Hashem, they disobeyed, they failed. It says that they didn't have water, and they moaned and mumbled and complained, right? It says they came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they said, are we going to have water? Will there be water for us and our wives and our children and our animals? Are you going to give us water? We're thirsty, we don't have water. And Hashem said, when they ask for water, that's one of the 10 times that they failed, and because of that, terrible things happened. It was a tremendous failure, a lack of faith. Why don't you trust me? I'm looking after you. I give you manna every day. Have I ever let you down? Right? Why don't you believe and have faith that I'll give you water? Now, let's look at it in the external way, the way we've been taught to look, and let's understand it inwardly. And I'm choosing this example because the Gemara, you don't need the Gemara for this. If you look at the words carefully in Tanakh, it says it so clearly. You know how it's taught normally? The Cheder teacher says to the little children, those ungrateful Jews, those people, Hashem saved them from slavery. He took them out of the torment of Egypt, and he looked after them, and he loved them, and he did everything for them. All they could do was moan. They mumbled and complained. They didn't stop bothering Hashem and asking him, where's this and where's that and where's that? That's the way it's taught in Cheder. What happened? Read in Tanakh. Don't look in the door. Just read over there. It says the people walked for 3 days without water. Remember that? So they walked in the desert for 3 days without water. At the end of 3 days, they are... Now, listen carefully. The Jewish people, 3 million people, they walked in the desert for 3 days without any water. Didn't carry any supplies with them. But the manna fell every day, and the Baal Shel Miriam was with them all the time. They drank and they ate what they needed, they had given when they needed it. They carried nothing. They walked in the desert for 3 days without water. That's what it says. The same source that says they failed and asked with a lack of emunah, lack of faith. The same word, a verse before, says that they walked for three... Have you ever been in Sinai? Ever been in Sinai desert? Ever been on a tiyul in the Sinai for 3 hours without any water? You know what happens? You're at least dehydrated. That's what happens in Sinai, even if used to it. Even if you're a nomadic Arab, right? Used to it, unless you're a camel. Yes? If you go in the Sinai desert for 3 hours, you die of dehydration. That's what happens. The Gemara says if a person doesn't drink for 3 days, they die. So the Gemara says. And eat and sleep also. But if you don't eat, I think. If you don't drink for 3 days, you die. Which means, listen to what their ordeal was. They walked with their little children in the desert of the Negev, right? Of the Sahara. The sun. They walked through the sun for 3 days.
Yeah.
At the end of 3 days, on the verge of death, it says that you don't drink for 3 days, you die. Just before they expired, that's what it is, right? They came to Moshe and they said, Moshe, is there going to be any water for us and for our children? And Hashem says, You failed. There's a test. I wanted to see if you really had faith. Have I ever let you down? Do you hear what's going on? Do you hear what's going on? But we don't teach it that way. But read the words. That's what it says. It's as plain as anything. What happened? They failed. Because at their level of greatness, they shouldn't have done it. At their level of greatness, they should have understood that it was a test and they were expected exactly that. To keep silent and wait until they were given. Do you follow? By the way, if you work it out, how long did they work in the desert? 40 years, right? Correct? 40 years. How many times did they fail? 10 times. It's not too bad. Once every 4 years to make a mistake? It's not such a bad record. Okay? Once every 4 years to make a mistake like asking for a bit of water when you're very, very thirsty and your children are about to die? That's not so bad. You follow me? You have to understand. You have to read the words carefully and objectively and see what happens. Let's take one or two more examples. No, maybe we'll leave it there. Okay? I think we've illustrated the principle. I don't want to keep you too late. But the approach to the subject is to remember the principles that we've said. The final work of the subject is that one has to take all these examples, right? One has to take these things. One has to look at the golden calf and what it was. Actually, the golden calf wasn't an act of idolatry. The golden calf was an act of trying to build a mishkan. They tried to build a focus for Hashem's Shekhinah. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't come down from the mountain when he was supposed to. And they were desperate. They were left in the desert without their connection to Hashem. All that meant anything to them was their connection to Hashem. They had nothing else. And when he didn't come down, they tried to build a mishkan. And you know what they built? They built one of the four corners of the mystical chariot on which Hashem rides. You know the chariot, the mystical merkava, has four corners. Face of a man, an eagle, a lion, and a calf. An ox. And they decided, if Hashem rides on that, let's build something like that in the world on which he'll ride. And maybe he'll speak to us again. And they were nearly right. Nearly right. A short time later, they were given a commandment to build what? Two golden cubits. Remember that? Two golden angelic forms, and Hashem spoke to them from between them. They almost had it. You follow what they were trying to do? Is there any way to understand that those people worshipped a piece of gold? Nothing could be sillier. You follow? This is your God. They met Hashem at Sinai. The most intense experience any human being ever experienced. They died when they met Hashem. Then Hashem flew out into Hashem's essence. And a few days later, they make a little piece of gold. You follow what's going on? A little piece of gold, bow down to it. Wasn't like that. What they wanted to do, they wanted to make a focus on which Hashem Shekhinah would ride in the world. We have to understand that in detail, why, and go through the whole thing. Ezra and Nehemiah. I said I wouldn't, I'm going to give you quickly a couple of words. Ezra and Nehemiah. It says the Jewish men had intermarried. The Jewish people had intermarried. That's why he couldn't take them back to Israel to build a base of Mikdash. You know how many men were involved? 40. 40 men, and the Jewish nation was much bigger than now. We're pathetically little now. Out of the millions of Jewish people, 40 men had married Babylonian women. And when Ezra told them, they instantaneously divorced them or converted them. They were either converted immediately. And that's not that bad. That's not that bad. When they entered Jericho, they weren't allowed to loot. They weren't allowed to loot. Correct? What happened? It was revealed that they'd been looting. And what does Tanakh say? It says you looted. Plural. You. A lot of you. Many of you looted. And you lost. What happened? They started investigating to find. They found that one man, Achan, had taken something. One man, Achan, had taken something. That's all. That's not bad. Millions of Jewish soldiers, they go into a place and they destroy these wicked people, and one man takes something home and took a scarf home for his wife. Yep, something like that. And what was the punishment? Thousands of Jews died. Thousands of Jews died. Yeah? Because when you're capable of 100 and you fall to 99, you get a terrible punishment. Because if you're striving for perfection, there's no gains. the risk, the price for being 100% is very great, but the risk is enormous. You follow me? If you want to live at 100% level, so the price will be enormous. The price is the next world. But the price is enormous. The price is tremendous. Right? If you want to live close to that voltage, you get fried if the voltage goes wrong. If you want to live at a lower voltage, you have less life. But it's not dangerous. You follow? That's what the mystics say. You want to live at that voltage. You want to live close to Hashem. After Hashem, by the way, Hashem said, go down quickly. Hashem said, take off your spiritual level and go down. And the Jewish people were devastated. We want to be close to you. Hashem said, you can't risk it anymore. You've shown that you're not 100% perfect. You can't risk the voltage up here. You follow? And they, unfortunately, they had to take a step down where only Moshe Rabbeinu remained on that level. And they no longer could relate at that level anymore. No consideration. So, that's what happened. So why were they punished? So you might say, but it's still unfair. One man took something, thousands died. Why is that? Why does the Torah speak in the plural as if you all looted? And why did thousands die? You know what the answer is? We are so close to perfection. The Jewish people is so close to perfection that we are all one. We are all mystically bound up together so intensely that if one Jew sins, you are responsible. Not only are you responsible, but you feel the consequence. If a Jew any place on earth does something wrong now, they're going to hold it against you. Practically and literally, by the way, not only mystically. If a Jew in Paris today does something he shouldn't do, and somebody finds out about it, your life is worth less. That's how it is. Not just because the Goyim look at us, because that's what the Jewish people are. You know what it means? The Jewish people are a chain. And a chain will snap at its weakest link. Do you follow? In other words, if Achan could take something, you know what it means? It means that everybody else in the Jewish people who wouldn't have looted, but they were close enough to doing it, you follow? They weren't as far away that one man could make the mistake of thinking that it wasn't so bad. They were responsible, you follow? And therefore they all punished for even having it allowed to enter their minds in such a way that somebody among them could actually take it so far as to do it. But they always, do you know what level of responsibility that is? Do you know what level of greatness and perfection that is? And that's always the story of the Jewish people. One person does something wrong, a few do something wrong, thousands pay the price. Because thousands are responsible. We are all responsible. You can't get away from it. If you cut one finger, you don't go, it's only that finger. The rest of it's fine. That's you. When one Jew bleeds, you bleed. That's how it works. Reuben. It says that Reuben had an intimate relationship with his father's wife. It says that. What happened? Look in Gemara. Gemara says this is what happened. Yaakov was married to Rachel. When Rachel died, Rachel was the beloved wife of Yaakov. When Rachel died, Yaakov moved his bed into the tent of one of the other wives, one of the other two. He did not move his bed into Leah's tent. And Reuben couldn't stand it. Reuben couldn't handle it. Reuben, one of the sons of Leah, was so jealous for his mother's honor and felt so deeply the pain that the man that she loved so deeply and had done so much to call her own in such a special way, had seen fit, right, that his personal intimate life should be organized in another way, do you follow, that Reuben just couldn't stand it. And it says he went and he took his father's bed and he moved it into his mother's tent. That's what he did. Look at my sin. What was, again, let's understand, what was his sin? What was his sin? Yaakov moved his bed from Rachel's tent into Bilhah Zilpah's tent. Reuben couldn't stand it. So he went and interfered with his father's intimate marital affairs, right? He took his father's bed and he moved it into his mother's tent. The Torah says that he had an intimate relationship with his father's mother, with his father's wife. So it says. Now, what's going on? Mephoshim say this. Because at his level of greatness, that's what it was. Why? Let's understand. What does it mean when a person interferes in that, it's difficult to discuss in detail, but what does it mean when a person interferes in that intimate area? A husband and wife have a certain thing between them. The thing they have between them is that the husband has exclusive rights to his wife. Intimately, he has the exclusive rights to his wife. She also to him. It's exactly the same, but we're not talking that way at the moment. From a man's point of view. He has exclusive rights to his wife. That's what marriage means. Adultery, right, means that you interfere in that intimacy. That you interfere, you come in between that covenant, right? That exclusive right that exists from husband to wife, adultery means breaking into that bond. You follow? That's what Reuben did. That's what Reuben did. Reuben came in between, you follow? His father Yaakov had a bond of exclusivity that was to his own wife. Reuben interfered with it. That's what he did. He broke that bond. Chas v'shalom to think that he would even dream of having an intimate. Can you imagine such a coarse crime? These are the worst part of the worst page of the worst publication that they'd sing on the worst day of the week.
Yeah.
You wouldn't find, you follow me, a picture of this kind of thing. I don't know, these days maybe you'd be, as I said before, these days probably a mixer. But you don't find that in Tanakh. You don't find that over there. He wouldn't. But what he did was, in his level, tantamount to that, and the Torah slams him for that. You interfered in that area of intimacy. That is the crime of adultery. That's what it is. You broke your father. You follow what's happening. Your father's married to this woman. You broke that bond. You interfered. You moved his bed. That's what adultery is in essence. Do you follow me? And at your level of greatness, it is called by that name and forever. It's called by that name forever in the Torah, and it goes down against Reuben for all time. You follow? But the chutzpah to think of it in the terms of the back page of a Sunday paper, the chutzpah to think of Reuben that way. That's what you object to. He did that crime in that way, and at his level of greatness, there's no whitewashing. You follow? The Torah is accurate exactly. But to bring it down to the level of some crude, coarse individual nowadays, and so it goes, on and on and on. Every sin of a great person of Tanakh. The Gemara searches and searches and searches before it finds a slight inkling of what the person did wrong. David, what he did wrong, he asked for a test, that's all. It wasn't adultery, it wasn't murder. He just asked for a test. But he slammed for it. Slammed for it. Yeah. That's the story of the Jewish people. And the Tanakh from beginning to end is a story of criticism. Right? The story of criticism. It's a story of a great people capable of 100% who gave their lives in torture over and over and over by the millions throughout the centuries. That's the level that we were at. Without thinking of happiness. And Avraham Avinu, who's asked to shech his son and begs to be allowed to do it out of his love for Hashem, to show that he loves Hashem more than anything that's his own vested interest. Even if it's his own child. That's the level that we're on. People capable of that. When you're capable of that, you slip. You slip at that voltage. You get fried. You get fried. You get burnt badly, and that's what happens. That's the story.